I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 6th, 2014. About a decade ago, Americans were getting rich by treating their homes like piggy banks. And then the housing market went kerblooey, and it was adios home equity lines of credit. So should we be giving home equity another chance? Plus, how technology is giving the humble tip jar an upgrade. And of course, your money questions. But first, data brokers. What are they? Who are they? Should we be worried about them? The Federal Trade Commission has issued a 110-page report getting at those questions, and here to tell us more about it is Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith. Hiya, Stacey.
Hi, David.
So a lot of people might not know that there's even a data broker industry out there. Tell us who these guys are.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a huge industry. It's companies like some of them you've heard of, Axiom, CoreLogic, maybe. They're very behind the scenes. But what they do is they're kind of behind your web page, you could think about it. So when you're surfing the web, they're behind there, usually planting cookies on your browser when you go to a certain web page or express a preference for something or buy something. And they take that little piece of information and they use it to create a profile of you, and they sell that profile to advertisers. So let's say Mercedes comes to them and says, we need people who would be likely to want a Mercedes SUV, and a company like Axiom or CoreLogic would be able to say, these are people in high income brackets who live in X part of the country who have expressed preferences to Mercedes. The amount of accuracy is amazing.
Because it's not just your online activities. They're also correlating that with your real-world activities, with what's known about your buying behavior, your shopping behavior, trips you might take, the entire thing. So when these guys put together a dossier on you, they're putting together a dossier on you.
No, that is really true. In fact, one of the companies that the FTC profiled had 3,000 pieces of data per consumer. And I talked with Jessica Rich. She's the director of the Bureau for Consumer Protection at the Federal Trade Commission. And she told me she was really surprised at the level of detail that these profiles had.
There's thousands and thousands of data elements on each consumer. They have urban scramble, which is a category referring to low-income and minority consumers. They have thrifty elders. They have diabetes interest, financially challenged, Bible lifestyle, African-American professional. There are these profiles that are developed on consumers that are at a level of specificity and detail that are mind-boggling.
All right, so why does the FTC think that we should be worried about these guys?
Right now, a lot of this information is used purportedly to show us ads for things we might be interested in, right? So I'm more likely to see an ad for, you know, pumps, and you are more likely to see an ad for windbreakers, right?
Or pumps.
Axiom would know better than I would. They're afraid that this data is going to get used in other ways. And other companies other than just advertisers have access to this data. We're talking about health insurance companies in general. For instance, one of the examples that Jessica Rich gave me was that there's a category called biker lifestyle, people who kind of are motorcycle people. And she said they could very likely have a lot of trouble getting life insurance or auto insurance, things like that, because of this category that they're in. So we could start experiencing discrimination without even being aware of where it's coming from or why.
So among things that the FTC is calling for is creation of some sort of website or web portal that would allow consumers to see what the data brokers know about them and possibly to opt out. What other measures is the agency calling for?
Well, they want, yes, like you said, people to be able to see what information is out there about them so that they can correct it. I mean, at least with something like a credit score, you can look at your credit report and see maybe why your credit score got dinged, if there was a light bill that wasn't paid, or if someone's stolen your identity, and you can talk to the credit agencies and try to get that stuff corrected. Because there is such a shroud of mystery around your data profile right now, it's impossible to correct mistakes. And also, if there's something that you don't want out there, you know, for instance, if you have a medical procedure and you don't want health insurance companies knowing about it, the idea would be that you could block that information.
I always feel like somebody is watching me. That's what I say. Stacey Vanek-Smith covers big data for Marketplace. Stacey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, David.
Watching me.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Way back when, that would be back in the early 2000s, people were treating their homes like ATMs. They'd be taking out money for college, for home improvements, for vacations, home equity lines of credit. That's what we're talking about here. HELOCs for short. And then the housing market collapsed and HELOCs went away. Well, guess what? The housing market is recovering. And HELOCs are back. And to tell us more about that, we're joined by financial journalist and founder of the site thinkglink.com, Elise Glink. Hi, Elise.
Hi, nice to be here.
Okay, so now let's talk about these home equity lines of credit, or HELOCs. Are they making a comeback?
Well, they're going to be making a comeback, but not quite yet, because the idea of a home equity line of credit is, get this, you have home equity. So if you don't have home equity, which is a problem for most Americans right now, unless you were very lucky and you bought, say, in 2009, 10, 11, or 12, but home equity loans are coming back. There's a bigger issue on the horizon, though, one that I think everybody ought to be very concerned about, which is that many of the home equity lines of credit that were set up back in the early aughts, as it's known, 2003, 4, 5, and 6, and 7, were interest only for the first 10 years. And then they have a little clause in them that says either you pay them off or whatever the balance is converts to a 15-year fixed rate loan. And that means that a whole lot of people, millions with billions with a B of dollars in HELOCs, are actually about to get a very rude surprise when they open their mail over the next couple of months.
And what sort of interest rates are they going to see?
Well, it's not that the interest rates are so high. It's just that now you're not paying interest only, you're paying principal and interest, and it's on a 15-year scale. So basically what you've done is taken whatever you've borrowed and you've turned it into a 15-year mortgage, which means that you're paying back an extraordinarily high amount of the principal along with a very low interest rate, which might be 3.5% or 4%. I mean, that's the amazing part of this, is that mortgage interest rates are, despite what everybody said, all the prognosticators have gone in the opposite way this year, and are actually hitting around 4% for a 30-year loan at about 3.25% to 3.5% for a 15-year loan. And so you might get that super low interest rate, but your payment could rise triple because now you're also paying back the principal in addition to the interest rate.
When the housing market went kerblooey, a lot of lenders circled their wagons. They started cutting back on these home equity lines of credit. Now that they're starting to loosen up the purse strings a little bit, how has the product changed?
Well, I think that one difference we're seeing is that lenders are a whole lot less eager to loan on these interest-only or what I would call pay option arms, where you literally would decide how much you're going to pay back for your home equity line of credit. And now what we're seeing instead is that everybody needs to know what they're going to pay. Banks need to be able to ascertain whether the person who's taking out the loan can actually afford to pay that back. And so I think you're going to see more rigorous underwriting, which of course will eliminate a lot of these loans. But also you're going to see the requirement of having a principal and interest payment right from the get-go. And where we're seeing that right from the start is from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo has long been known as the leader of home equity line of credit lending. And they're making this change, and they account for maybe not quite 20% of the market, but a significant chunk, and I think other lenders are going to follow suit.
Well, everybody likes the idea of getting a vacation or putting their kid through school or making some home improvements, but is a loan like this for everybody? You're essentially borrowing against your house.
You are, and there's a whole lot of places where people think that's a really bad idea, and there are a whole lot of financial experts who think putting your house at risk is kind of a dumb idea. It's no dumber, frankly, than doing a zero down loan that was interest only, where you didn't pay any equity into the house either. So I think those kinds of loans have gone away completely. We've seen lots of regulators frown on them. And the same thing is going to be true for home equity line of credit. The difference is that if you have substantial assets above and beyond the annual income that you earn. So let's say, for example, you own a lot of investment property or you have all kinds of stocks in the bank or a big inheritance. I think some lenders will be able to work with you more creatively, shall we say? And for everybody else who just has a W-2 and is trying to figure out why you're still not making as much as you did in 2006, it's going to be less available.
Is there any downside to being approved for a HELOC and then not using the money?
Not at all. So what's interesting about HELOCs is the way that they affect your credit history. In some HELOCs, and you should ask this question when you're getting it, exactly how will you be reporting this to my credit history? If you have a HELOC, let's say for $100,000 and you use $10,000 of it, you would assume that you've used just 10% of your available credit. But the way that some HELOCs were reported, it looked though as though that you were taking out 100% of your available credit. So it was reported that you were taking out $10,000 and your credit limit was $10,000, which is a really bad thing for credit histories. The thinking behind why somebody would do that, why some bank would do it, is to avoid their clients getting cherry-picked, because in the heyday of HELOCs, everybody wanted everybody else's good clients and customers, and so they would go and try and cherry-pick them. So I'm not saying that's officially why that was happening, but it is one possible explanation.
You mentioned earlier how those interest-only loans are now going to come due, and we're going to start seeing a surge in these payments. Are you expecting a surge in refis as a result?
Well, it would be really nice to be able to refi. I think a lot of people who have taken out home equity lines of credit would like to just simply wrap it all together and refinance into one big loan. And here's the problem. 10 million people are still functionally underwater with their mortgages. That means if they went and tried to do that today, they either wouldn't have enough equity in the house, or they literally have zero or negative equity. And there's no way for a regular lender to refinance them. So I get heartbreaking letters every week from my readers at thinklink.com and my syndicated column, or they listen to my show. They would really like to refinance and package all of these things together and get one low interest rate at the super low interest rates of where we are this week. And it's not possible. And so I think there's going to be a day of reckoning here for people who borrowed money maybe 10 years ago. And from now through 2017, when the big bulk of these HELOCs start to convert and come due, we're going to see increased amount of people who can't pay them. So there's going to be increasing defaults. We're going to maybe see an increasing level of foreclosures due to HELOCs. I mean, people are really going to be struggling to make it work. They're making less money or the same money, and yet the payment is now going to be an extra $200, $400, $500, $700 a month, and they simply don't have it. And those loans are going to go into default.
All right, something to be watching for. Financial journalist Elise Gling, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Up next on the show, I'll be tackling your most vexing of money questions. And later on, technology is making us better tippers, but not without a little extra stress and shame thrown in for good measure.
Baristas and bakers and sandwich makers are sort of seeing an upside, which is great for them. They deserve more tips, but from the customer perspective, it's creating kind of a stressful, awkward moment up there at the counter.
Are mobile payment apps changing how Americans tip? Reporter Rachel Levin joins us to break it down. That's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times. All right, we're finally up to my favorite part of the show, because this is your part of the show, where I take a stab at answering some of your money questions. And we'll get into that in a moment. I just wanted to point out something first. There's an academic journal out there called Social, Psychological, and Personality Science. And researchers had a thing in there just the other day talking about how your output is valued by others. And this is of interest to all of us working stiffs out there, because you want to think that if you're out there busting hump, your boss is going to notice and will reward you, or at least throw some attaboys your way. Well, guess what? The researchers ran a study looking at what happens when people met or exceeded others' expectations. And you know what? There was no extra reward for exceeding those expectations. All that extra work, all that extra sweat and labor, basically unnoticed and unrewarded. Does that mean you should slack off at the job? I don't think so. It's just kind of worth keeping in mind that if you're expecting pats on the head, it might not be coming, at least not as you're expecting. All right, let's get into the questions. First up, we have Jessica in Orlando, Florida. Hiya, Jessica.
Hi, David.
So what's new in Orlando, Florida?
Oh, just enjoying the summer.
Hot and humid?
Yes, very much so.
What's to enjoy with hot and humid?
Oh, plenty of beaches and pools and theme parks.
Okay. Well, do people in Orlando really go to theme parks?
We go during the winter.
Like we do here in L.A. with Disneyland.
Exactly.
What is the theme park di tutti theme parks at the moment?
Right now, we are into SeaWorld and Legoland, trying to stay a little bit away from the mouse.
I'm big on Legoland. I was happily surprised by Legoland when
it's
I first
great.
Encountered it. Yeah, it's great. I want to shake the hand of the guy who invented Legos. I mean, just what an awesome toy.
Absolutely.
And you got a Harry Potter world out there, too, don't you?
We do. We do.
Is it totally
just
cool?
Expanded. It is pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome. I haven't been to the new part, but the original was pretty amazing.
So, like, my kid is totally a Hogwarts kind of guy. Would he dig it?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you as a parent can enjoy some butter beer while you're there.
Even though I'm a full-on muggle?
Yeah.
All right. So let's get to your thing. So what's going on in your life?
So we've been debating. We live in a family-owned home right now. It's owned by my husband's family while his mother is living somewhere else. And my oldest child is about to start school. Unfortunately, the home isn't in a very good school district. So we are debating if we should continue his private school education, starting in kindergarten in the fall, or if we would be better off investing in a new home and taking on a mortgage payment in a better school district.
All right, that's interesting. So you're basically talking about the coin toss of, are we going to go down the private school road, which is expensive, or are we going to splurge on a house, which is expensive?
Yes.
Interesting. All right, now let's get one thing out of the way. In both cases, it sounds like the priority is investing in your child.
Yes.
So that's the thing, correct?
Yes.
All right, so now it's going to be a matter of how you're going to structure the investment. How much have you been paying for preschool?
Preschool has been about $11,000 a year.
And what's the deal with that, right?
I know.
$11,000. Are you kidding me? All parents have gone down that road. What are you looking at for kindergarten and beyond?
It will actually go down slightly to $9,000, but in 2 years, his little sister will be following, and so she will be going in the same route.
So you're looking at a potential $18,000 to $20,000 annual hit right there.
Correct.
Okay, that's some serious coin. Now, on the housing front, if you wanted to, could you go out and buy a house?
Yes, I think so.
So you could hit that 20% down payment, for example?
No, we could not, but we do qualify for a VA loan.
Okay.
So we could do it with as little as, I think, 5% down if necessary.
All right. So now it's just going to be a matter of how you want to shape these finances going forward. And this is going to be your call, ultimately, because neither of these is the wrong decision. But let me give you what comes to my mind right here. And that is, when we talk about investing in your kid, all right, that's the high-quality education. And you want that either through a private school or by getting into a neighborhood that has a really good public school. Yes?
Sure. Yes.
All right. So that's the kid. The kid is covered. Now it's a matter of how are you going to make the most out of your investment in the future of your family. And then it comes down to, are we putting these big bucks into the private school, or are we going down the housing road and start making mortgage payments and, you know, becoming homeowners? That, to me, seems like the smart play, because now you're investing in your future as opposed to simply your child's here and now.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And, I mean, just so you know, when I moved back to L.A. from the Bay Area, I was facing the exact same question you're facing, and I looked at it and thought, you know what, the smart play for me, pick a good school district, pick one that has a really good public school, and then work out housing in that area, as opposed to trying to target a private school and, you know, just kind of not knowing what else is going to happen in my life, except that I'd be looking at a serious investment in my kid year after year.
Absolutely.
And that's why we went down that road. And so we picked our neighborhood specifically to the public school that we liked. At the time, it was an elementary school. And that's, for my money, the single most important public school. That's where it all starts happening. That's where the ball gets going. That's where the parents are participating the most. And then it feeds up to hopefully a good middle school, then a good high school, then your kid goes to Harvard, then they're making tons of money, and you never work again in your life.
That's what I'm hoping for.
That's my plan. I'm not sure it's going to work out like that exactly, but I'm comfortable with the decision I made. And I think you can be comfortable with that decision as well, because even if you end up not liking that school, the public school that is, you still have the option of going to a private school. And yet at the same time, you're also investing in your future, that is the house.
Wonderful. And do you think it's wise for us to go in as little as 5% down with the VA loan, or should we possibly send him to private school for a couple of years to try to sock away a little bit more money for the down payment?
I think if you've got the VA loan, I would dive right in. And the reason I'm saying that is because the timing works in your favor. The housing market is starting to recover. Interest rates are still relatively low. That's your friend here. And you kind of have the best of all worlds because sellers are returning to the marketplace. There's good inventory coming to the marketplace. And you're able to get terms that are going to be very attractive. And so I would think that you've got a real sweet spot here that's going to work to your advantage.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, David.
I appreciate that. And the next time you're drinking butterbeer, you think of me, okay?
I will.
Take care, Jessica. All right, I'm looking here at some of my email. And before I get to the next call, this was an email that jumped out at me, so I just want to run it down real quick. This one's from Kim in Minneapolis. And it's kind of convoluted, but the long and the short of it is she's inherited $24,000 in credit card debt after what she calls the demise of a 10-year relationship, which means she's probably backing that debt, which is not something you want to be doing. So be very careful when you sign on as a guarantor, that kind of thing. She says, I've got student loan debt. And she says, she's also working a full-time job, making about $37,000 a year, living paycheck to paycheck, making the minimum monthly payments on her various forms of debt, including the credit cards. And her question here, should she go down the debt consolidation road, which she says she thinks could end up costing her more, or should she be looking at bankruptcy, which she doesn't want to do? How should she play this? All right. First of all, keep in mind, bankruptcy not going to get you off the hook for that student debt. That's the one form of debt that does not go away when you file for bankruptcy. Also, you file for bankruptcy and your credit score carries the mark of Cain for years. So that's not good either, especially now that the economy is recovering and you're going to want a little flexibility because you never know. You might be seeking other loans. You might want to buy a house. Things can happen. So I don't know if bankruptcy is your best friend here. Debt consolidation, it can work. It's a matter of finding a lender who's going to offer good terms. And then you bring it all in under one roof, and it can work. Will it be more expensive than your current payments? Possibly, but it'll be more manageable, too, because it'll all be in one place. But that's not exactly the next move I think you want to make. What you want to do at this point, Kim, is go online. There's a couple of resources that I want you to check out. One of them is the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. The other one is the Association of Independent Consumer Credit Counseling Agencies. Both these guys have websites that will allow you to search for a licensed credit counselor. In other words, someone you can trust, hopefully someone at a nonprofit who's not going to try and nickel and dime you with this sort of thing. And these folks know the landscape better than anybody. And they're going to be able to steer you down a path that's probably going to work well for you. And moreover, they can frequently act as an intermediary with your various creditors, bring them to the table, help them cut more amenable terms. And before you know it, you got your hands around this thing, as opposed to that feeling of frustration and helplessness, which is what stops a lot of people from taking proactive action when it comes to debt. And I really want to leave everybody with the impression here, which is the correct impression, you can manage your debt. You can get your hands around it. A little bit of a hassle, can be a little bit of pain involved. You're not going to get off scot-free by any stretch of the imagination, but you can get control of your life again, and that's very important. Kim, send us an email. Let us know what you decide, okay? We're going to take a quick break, but stick around because we're going to have more money questions in just a bit. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus with the LA Times, and let's get right back into answering your money questions. And our next call is Carla calling from Suwanee, Georgia. Carla, how are things in Suwanee, Georgia?
Everything's going great. How are things on your end?
Things are great at my end, but you got to help me out with Suwanee because all I know is the song. And I just can't, I don't have a mental image in my mind of what Suwanee is, except I picture trees and a river and plantations and, you know.
No,
No.
Well, Suwannee is really nice and pretty. It's had like a lot of new developments lately. You have a really beautiful park area, the town center, and it's really gorgeous there.
So you're seldom on a hilltop saying, "I'll never go hungry again." That's not you, it sounds like.
No.
Oh, okay.
Not like that at all.
I had totally the wrong image in my mind. I can't imagine where I got that.
No.
All right. Tell me about where you're coming from, Carla.
Okay. So, I was recently accepted to a physician assistant program here in Atlanta, and the program is 2.5 years, it's 7 semesters, and the total cost is about $75K. And so I was thinking about paying, of course, with loans, but also wondering if I should borrow money from my husband's 401K to partially finance school. And so that's where I wanted your help.
Okay, let's back up a sec. Physician assistant, that's like a nurse, but not?
No. So some people consider them to be a mid-level practitioner. You can do pretty much everything a doctor can, except you can't perform surgeries on your own. But it's a pretty high-level position. They make about $90K first year coming out of graduate school.
So this is the next level up from nurse practitioner.
You could say it's on the same level, nurse practitioners and physician assistant.
That's a totally cool gig. What got you into that?
So I like it. I like the fact that physician assistants, they practice on the medical model, which is the same as physicians, but it seems like they have a lot more time, a little bit more time to dedicate to their patients. Their patient load isn't as heavy. And so I was treated by a physician assistant when I grew up. And so I really, really like the profession. And they're basically time that they're able to split between practice and their home life. So I thought it was a great profession, especially for women.
In fact, everything I hear from doctors is that the future of medicine is physician assistants, nurse practitioners, people who will serve as the new front line of medicine in terms of the interaction and the wellness of their patients.
Yes, and that's a lot of what they focus on is patient health and wellness and well-being.
All right, so first of all, congratulations, and that's totally cool, and I'm very happy for you. Now, in terms of, in terms of how you should deal with that $75,000 cost, listeners of this show know exactly what I'm about to say, and that is dipping into your 401k, no, don't do that for goodness sakes. Your retirement money is your retirement money. And granted, there's going to be emergencies that come up in life where you're going to have to go for it and rob from your future to pay for your present. I'm not saying that'll never happen, but if you can avoid it, you want to do so at all costs, because preparing for your retirement, just can't say this enough, it is the single most important financial step you are going to take, because down the road, that's when you're going to be patting yourself on the back and saying, God, I was smart for taking those steps back then.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
So that then raises the question, if you are not going to be robbing your 401k, how are you going to pay this?
So then probably basically with federal loans, unsubsidized loans, and direct plus loans.
And how doable is that for you?
That's very possible for me.
Are you carrying student debt?
I am.
How much?
About $28K.
Okay, so you're looking at possibly walking away after you finish your schooling with as much as $100,000 in debt. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying when you approach debt of that magnitude that isn't a mortgage, you and your husband simply need to be on the same page of there it is. How are we going to deal with it? What is our plan for paying it down? You don't want something like that sitting over there on the other side of the room leering at you. Instead, you guys want to be in control of something like that. And basically from the get-go, knowing that it's coming and knowing that you have a plan to deal with it. That's really important.
Okay.
So that's a conversation. That's something that you and your husband need to talk about. And just make sure you're on the same page. It's not a bad thing to have that level of debt. It's just something that a couple wants to be controlling of as opposed to being controlled by.
Yeah. Okay. Right now, we're only living off of his income. So afterwards, the plan was to continue living on one income and then take care of all of our debts with my income.
And then after you become a physician assistant, you can provide all the health care for the family. So think of the savings.
Yep.
All right, Carla, really good talking to you. And I'm still trying to work out that head of my – I'm still trying to get out of my head whether you're standing outside of Tara or not. But, okay.
No, well, right now I'm at the Braves and Mariners game, so –
That is so not Tara. That is something else entirely. Carla, good talking to you. Send me an email. Let me know how it all works out, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, great. Thanks.
Bye.
Next, you know that old saying, keep it simple, stupid? Well, it might not apply when it comes to saving for retirement.
In the past, it was real simple. You retired at 62, you took your Social Security benefits, end of story. But that was in the days when people actually quit work at 62, they may have a pension, and they probably weren't going to live 30 years in retirement.
Plus, we'll hear what musician Steve Albini has to say about the role of money in his life. That's all up next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times. We all know how important Social Security is. It's like hardly a week goes by without us hearing about the status of things. The program's in jeopardy. It's not in jeopardy. It'll be there for us. It won't be there for us. But if you're currently receiving Social Security, or soon will be, are you getting the most out of it? You might be surprised by what you don't know about what's arguably the most popular program Uncle Sam ever came up with. And to tell us more about that, we're joined by Mary Beth Franklin. She's a contributing editor at Investment News. Mary Beth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for asking me, David. I appreciate it.
All right. So Social Security is obviously a very complicated landscape, but I'll bet you most people don't even realize that there might be some wiggle room when it comes to getting the most for your benefits.
Absolutely. You know, in the past, it was real simple. You retired at 62, you took your Social Security benefits, end of story. But that was in the days when people actually quit work at 62, they may have a pension, and they probably weren't going to live 30 years in retirement like a lot of today's retirees will. Now, in an era of disappearing pensions, record low interest rates where you're getting diddly squat on your CDs at the bank, you really need to make the decision of how and when to claim Social Security in a way that's going to benefit you. And what will surprise most people is your decision how and when to claim could mean the difference of thousands of dollars a year in your benefit. And for a married couple, we are talking the difference of more than $100,000 over their joint lifetime. That's real money.
So what are you talking about here? Whether I'm going to step up and claim it at 67 or the age of 70?
So here's the basic landscape. Anybody can claim a Social Security retirement benefit as early as age 62, but their benefit will be permanently reduced for the rest of their lives. If your normal retirement age is 66, you take it at 62, you get a permanent 25% haircut. If your full retirement age is 67 and you take it at 62, you get a 30% haircut. This is a big deal considering Social Security for most Americans going forward is going to be the only source of guaranteed cost of living adjusted retirement income they'll ever see.
So the bottom line is put it off for as long as I can until I start collecting those checks.
Generally, it works. But as I tell a lot of my audiences, the idea of delaying a Social Security benefit until it's worth more later is a little bit like the lottery. You must be present to win. You know, if you're in a state of health where you may not make it to the average life expectancy, which is closer to 80 or beyond for most people, don't delay. It's not going to be in your best interest. But if you're relatively healthy, you can expect to live a long time, and delaying your benefit till it's worth more later is really smart. For example, I said if 66 is your full retirement age, you get 100% of what your benefit that's promised to be. But if you wait even longer, and a lot of people don't realize this, for every year you postpone collecting your Social Security benefit beyond your full retirement age, up until age 70, you get an extra 8% per year. That means if you wait till 70, you're going to get a 32% bump in your Social Security benefit. And that means you will have a larger benefit going forward. And each year when you get an annual cost of living adjustment, it's going to be that much bigger.
I was asked by a reader the other day, if they decide to get Social Security early, like let's say at the age of 62, and then decide, no, I think I'm going to put it off a little more, they asked me, could I kick it back and then collect later? I was surprised by the answer to that.
Yes, there actually is a do-over strategy. There's two of them, actually. If you are within 12 months of first claiming Social Security benefits, you can change your mind, say, never mind, I'm going to withdraw my application for Social Security benefits, but you have to pay back everything you've received. But if you miss your 12-month window, you may be out of luck. People also don't realize that once they reach their full retirement age, which again is 66, you can voluntarily suspend your benefit. Now, that means you wouldn't get any benefit temporarily, but if you suspend your benefits, you earn those 8% per year delayed retirement credits between 66 and 70.
So let's look at a more narrow scenario. What if I've been working my entire life, but my spouse hasn't been? What's his or her situation?
First of all, to collect Social Security benefits, you actually have to be paying into the Social Security system. Essentially, you had to work at least 10 years to get enough quarters to qualify for Social Security benefits. Or you can be married to someone who qualifies for benefits, just the situation you just described. Let's say we have Ozzie and Harriet. Ozzie's worked his whole life. He is eligible for Social Security benefits. Harriet stayed home with the kids. She doesn't have any Social Security benefit on her own, but she's entitled to one as a spouse. A spousal benefit is worth half of the worker's Social Security benefit. That's in addition to what he gets if the wife collects it at her full retirement age or later. But she can't collect a spousal benefit until Ozzie collects his. Now, let's say he's heard this conversation about the value of delaying Social Security benefits until they're worth more later, up until age 70. So he wants to wait, but Harriet wants her benefit now. So one of the things he can do is called file and suspend. This says to Social Security that now that I have reached my full retirement age of 66, I want to file and suspend. That means I am filing for the purpose of triggering my wife's spousal benefit while I am suspending my own, and they continue to grow at 8% per year up until age 70. So this is a great strategy for a traditional married couple where you can get some money into the household now, and the bigger earner is going to delay as long as possible to get the biggest retirement benefit possible. And there's two reasons to do that. Not only will there be a bigger retirement income going forward for this couple, but if Ozzie dies first, and actuarially, men tend to die before their wives, when the worker dies, the surviving spouse gets the biggest benefit. So her little spousal benefit is going to go away, but she is going to inherit 100% of his benefit.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Medicare, which is Social Security's ugly stepchild. Is there a way to game that system as well?
Well, I wouldn't call gaming the system. And when you think about it, on your 65th birthday, you get probably the best present from Uncle Sam you could ever get, which is access to health care regardless of your health. Medicare is an incredible benefit for people 65 and older. we know that medical expenses in retirement are going to be one of the biggest expenses that retirees face. And yet there hasn't been a really good way to quantify the cost of it. And how do you make a good retirement income plan if you don't know what your biggest expense is going to cost you? So part of the strategy of delaying Social Security benefits is there may be more money available to pay those ever-increasing Medicare premiums.
Can younger people today even count on these programs being there for them when they're going to need them?
Social Security has had these surplus funds, the trust funds, that have been building up over the last 30 years. And now that the baby boomers are starting to retire, we're starting to draw them down. But even if the trust funds, quote, ran dry around 2033, which is what is projected, there would still be enough money coming in, day out from those FICA payroll taxes to pay about 75% of promised Social Security benefits. Now, no one's ever going to be satisfied with 75% of promised benefits. I firmly believe that Congress, sometime before 2033, will step in and do the right thing to shore up this incredibly popular and successful program. Remember, Social Security was never designed to be the be-all and end-all of retirement savings. It's really the retirement safety net. And, you know, we used to talk about the three-legged stool of retirement security: pensions, personal savings, and Social Security. Well, pensions are history for most of the population. Personal savings are inadequate for many people. And Social Security, as we've just discussed, is a little wobbly. So we've gone from a three-legged stool to a pogo stick. And that's really no way to build retirement security.
I plan to win the Powerball, so I think I'm covered.
I think that works. Yeah, absolutely.
Mary Beth Franklin is the author of Maximizing Your Client's Social Security Retirement Benefits. Mary Beth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Check out the web version of this story to find out how you can get more bang out of Social Security at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM. Tipping. Well, that's one of those things that'll sizzle people's bacon. You never know how much to tip, where to tip, who to tip. Well, of course, there's an app for that these days. However, is that a good thing? Rachel Levin, a journalist based in the Bay Area, wrote recently about tipping and its electronic derivatives like Square, ShopKeep, and PayPal here. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when it comes to tipping, how does technology figure into the equation?
Well, these days you'll see that the tip jar has sort of taken a back seat to the iPad. You know, maybe there's a tip jar next to your coffee counter, but increasingly you're seeing an iPad swiveled towards you with prompts promoting your finger to press either 15%, 20%, 25%, or sometimes in cautionary bright yellow, no tip, which no one wants to press because you'll feel like a jerk.
Yeah, no pressure there. So if you're a barista, obviously that's a good thing. But if you're a customer, there's a sense of pressure that you have to put up the tip now and you don't really have much of a choice.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people like baristas and bakers and sandwich makers are sort of seeing an upside, which is great for them. They deserve more tips. But from the customer perspective, it's creating kind of a stressful, awkward moment up there at the counter.
Well, I had a similar situation, too. I ordered a pizza. The guy comes to the door. I pay with a credit card, and he does this all with his iPhone, which is magical to me. And then he hands it to me to do my little finger signature, and there's a thing for a tip right there. And normally with the pizza guy, I'd tip maybe a couple bucks, $3 maybe. I never really think about a 20% tip. Suddenly I'm faced with the idea of a 20% tip for a pizza.
Right. And he's standing right there in front of you. So it's more awkward.
It's very awkward. Yeah. And you feel like, first of all, I'm being pressured to this, but then you look at your whole life and you think, God, have I cheated pizza men out of their tips for years now?
Exactly. The list of who we're supposed to tip is kind of changing with this new technology, and how much we tip is changing. And, you know, it's great for them, but it's changing the dynamic. Actually, there's an app I've sort of grown obsessed with called Caviar that takes away your pizza delivery at the door moment, because it's automatic now, like your tip is included, and so you don't have to struggle around looking for a few extra bucks or figure out how much to give them. You just take your pizza, say thank you, and close the door. It's very easy.
And pizza guy knows that I've done Caviar and that I'm not stiffing him?
Exactly.
But this raises an interesting question as well, and that is, we associate tipping with a reward for good service, and thus we are approaching it as an incentive for the server to step up his or her game. And yet this electronic revolution seems to make the gratuity almost gratuitous, because now it's just being built into the entire transaction, regardless of service.
Exactly. It's taking away that social interaction. And it turns out, actually, that we don't really tip. Our motivations for tipping are not for rewarding service necessarily, but an economist, Michael Lena Cornell, says it's to win the approval of the server. And so now when that server is standing before you, that creates the pressure for you to then bestow a bigger tip. But then when that social interaction is taken away and you then move to automate your tip, it's it creates sort of an easier, smoother transition.
Well, easier and smoother, perhaps, but it also seems that instead of the consumer being empowered to pass judgment on the quality of service, I'm simply underwriting the cheapskate business owner who can't pay his people a living wage.
Exactly. It's true. It's then just sort of becoming an automated part of our everyday consumer behavior. You know, mobile payment systems like Square and ShopKeep, and this one I used this morning called Revel, which didn't even offer 15%. The lowest was 18%.
Oh, shut the front door, really?
Yeah, I went looking for 15 because I just ordered a drip coffee. But then there was no 15, and I wasn't going to. You do have the option to manually type in, but I wasn't going to bother with that. So I went for 18.
Oh, that's just rude.
Anyways.
So what do consumers have to say? Has there been any backlash about this new electronic revolution in tipping?
I don't know if there's been a backlash yet, as apart from people just sort of talking amongst their friends about feeling awkward at the coffee counter suddenly when they never have before. People are sort of silently appreciating the new technology where it's used, say, with Uber Taxi, where you don't have to pay a tip. Tip is included for Uber Taxi, 20% automatically deducted from your account. And regular Uber drivers are just given a fair wage or commission. So you hop out of the Uber Taxi without having to do any mental math or figure out how much change to ask for. And you just kind of go on your way and say thank you and shut the door.
But what if I didn't have a great experience? What if my Uber driver was singing show tunes the entire way? That's not a 20% phenomenon to me.
It's true. You have no choice. They're gonna get that added 20% anyway. But you can then, I guess, give them a 2 out of 5 stars. But I don't know what the company does with those star ratings. Maybe they get a bonus. Maybe they get a warning to stop singing show tunes. I'm not sure.
Rachel Levin is based in the Bay Area, where she covers technology and other topics. Rachel, I'm hitting the touch screen right now. 25% right there.
Thank you. So generous.
Question: how much did your upbringing influence how you spend money? Once in a while, we like to turn the mic over to others to hear a story about just that topic. And today, the musician and engineer who recorded The Pixies and Nirvana, he gained a work ethic early on in life. But as for the profit motive, never mind.
My name is Steve Albini. I'm a sound recording engineer. I own the recording studio Electrical Audio in Chicago, and I'm a musician. I'm a member of the band Shellac of North America. I grew up in Montana on a mountain in an area called Grant Creek. My upbringing was largely rural, hunting, fishing, the great outdoors, distance from other people, that sort of thing. From a very early age, all of us kids, there were 3 children in the family, were all encouraged to earn spending money. As soon as I was physically capable of holding down a job, I had one. I think my first job, I was 7 years old. I was a shoeshine boy at the Top Hat Barber Shop. It's always seemed appropriate for me that I would earn whatever money anyone had to give me rather than me feeling like I was entitled to it. That sounds like a kind of a self-made man capitalist perspective, but my association with money other than my income is quite a bit different. And philosophically, I don't think of myself as a capitalist. I actually think that the profit motive is a symptom of a pathology, and that it is a very dangerous and toxic influence on society. I do what I can to undermine it as a business owner and as an employer. I try to be more equitable with the money that's temporarily under my control. The studio that we built in Chicago was built largely by a self-motivated crew of people from the music scene, people who wanted to learn how to build a studio, and we basically provided a nexus for that. From the earliest days of my involvement in music, money has always been a problem. You know, finding the resources to do something, to get a guitar fixed or buy a new amplifier or make a recording. And I feel a great sense of pride in making our studio available to people at modest and affordable rates. It's not just out of kindness, because I know that the most interesting, most creative music is often made at the margins. So people who are least likely to have money to burn in the studio are the people most likely to be doing stuff that's ultimately going to become culturally important and ultimately going to become the most satisfying to have worked on. The money that comes into the studio is used first to keep the studio in order, and then goes out to the employees in as equitable a fashion as I can muster. As a result, the studio constantly improves and becomes a more and more valuable resource to the musical community in Chicago.
Steve Albini is a musician, recording engineer, and owner of Electrical Audio Studios in Chicago. That's Marketplace Money for this week. I'll be back again next week, I'm glad to say, splashing around in the money pool. And then Lizzie O'Leary returns at the end of this month with a brand new show. Join us then for Marketplace Weekend. Right now, roll credits. Marketplace Money is produced by Candace Manriquez and Caitlin Fenaro, with help from Nick White. Our senior producer is Dan Simatovich. Robbie Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. Remember to always check with your financial pro before you make any big money decisions. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. APM.